It is time to bring in David Tarachuk with the Media Beat. David, of course, joins us on a Friday morning. We're extremely lucky to have him every Friday. He is also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. And you can find him on the web with his own website, which is themediabeat.us. But like I said, on Fridays, you can find him right here. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Live with you Friday morning, coming in from the media capital of the world, New York City, as usual.
Well, there's nothing to talk about. We can end the show.
It's been a quiet week in the media world. No, it has not. And by the way, you know, as I say, I'm coming from New York, as most times. Anyway, I come from New York with this show. And I guess it's a long expressed notion that if you have to read the New York Times to catch up with a social phenomenon or a trend or something, you are just not with it. Reading something in the New York Times as a new social trend or similar is like admitting you just don't know what's going on. But I wanted to celebrate a piece of knowledge I gained only from the New York Times, my hometown newspaper, today. There is a phenomenon in the internet community called doom scrolling, and we're all doing it, apparently. Have you heard that phrase?
No, I haven't.
Well, join me in being illuminated. Doom scrolling is, of course, spending all your time on the screen looking down at more and more bad news. It's bad news after bad news, they say. And getting into this habit of living on the web, looking, you don't even have to actively look for, but just concentrate on when you see it, nothing but the bad stuff. That apparently is doom scrolling. Let's not try to do that today, but it has to be said, there's an awful lot of bad stuff out there, and has been for many months now. It can get very depressing.
And it's, you know, it's funny, that's why I limit my watching television, general television, to literally about 15 to 20 minutes, maybe 30 minutes. And most of that is Anderson Cooper, by the way, on CNN. Other than that, it's over to my network of Prime and Netflix and stuff like that, because there's just too much bad news, and there's too much. It wouldn't be bad if there was just news about the bad news, but then you have all these talking heads talking about the bad news.
Sure, masquerading as news. They call themselves news shows, but in fact they're opinion, and very often yelling opinion shows. And that's no good to anybody. I have to do this for a living. I do have to keep up. So and so do you. So it's difficult. But the idea of rationing is really important, I believe. And as you know, I've often celebrated my own approach and tried to recommend it for others if they're interested. A Sabbath is a pretty good idea too. One day off a week from the news completely is no bad thing. You can easily catch up on Monday morning if it's Sunday you take as your media Sabbath. But it can be any day of the week, of course. And I think, you know, it's probably a good idea to have a kind of social, mainstream media and social media as well, perhaps, nap in the day. Just set aside an hour or two when you just don't respond to anything at all that comes in via screaming screen, or the phone or whatever it is that you let in the outside world, and it's grim news.
You know, we all, you know, the thing that gets me is we all know that the White House press briefings are simply a joke. I hate to say that, but they are.
Pretty bad joke, but
yeah,
a joke.
A joke. We all know when the president gets up in the Rose Garden that it's going to be a political speech, because he's using the Rose Garden as a campaign lectern there. We all know that. We all know that Joe Biden is coming out once or twice a week with plans and things like that. But what we fail to realize, that with all we are so concerned about Donald Trump and about coronavirus and how the CDC no longer is being bypassed by the Trump administration. There are other things in the world that are going on that are just as important. The first stories that came out about the COVID-19 virus possibly being stolen with all these. Well, of course Russia is going to do that. I mean, Russia is involved in elections throughout the world, including our country. But people should take more attention to that story, because there's only seven companies across the world, and one really in the United States, which is partnered with that other one, that are working on making a vaccine. So, of course, you take a country like Russia, which is now experiencing its own outbreak, and their technological expertise in managing to infiltrate with the internet, of course that's going to happen. But that story is put down in second and third place, David, with the coverage of what we already know to be true.
Yeah, I'm glad to see my hometown newspaper, which I stand by most of the time, although I'm quite prepared to critique it rigorously too. Made that particular story its lead for this week, and rightly so. You're of course correct. I mean, it's a major story, and it's not just part of the great coronavirus mélange, if you like, or the flood of COVID stories. It's significant in its own right, and of course it should also not be any great surprise either. You're right about Russia concentrating on this form of international mischief for its own advantage. It has a branch of its intelligence services and its military dedicated to entirely to it. Internet research is one of the euphemisms they use, and that's, you know, it's absolutely inevitable that getting their own hands on what research there is going on to produce a vaccine is something they were bound to do. And here they are doing it in the opinion, the pretty well confirmed opinion of several Western intelligence services, not just our own.
You know, we've been used to China. China is very good at stealing industrial secrets. They've been doing it for years. They've been doing it before the internet. They've been doing it for a long time. So why should we be surprised about Russia also doing this? Because, you know, we used to have a technological advantage here in this country, but now these countries have got to branch out and learn how to steal from other countries, because it's not just the U.S. And with all what's going on in the U.S., it's not just the U.S. That leads now in finding these vaccines and these cures.
Oh, far from it. No, yeah. I mean, I don't want to be jingoistic about my own former home country, but some of the most furthest along research is taking place in Oxford, England, and of course, you know, it's much of the American work is partnering with overseas partners too. It's not as if this is some kind of precious national resource. It should be a shared resource, but even fairly shared, not shared by the tricks and the subterfuge of spying.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And I ask your opinion on what is going on. What really is upset me, and it really it caused me to watch less news when I heard that the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, was going to be bypassed with the statistics, and they're going to go right to the White House, which has hired somebody to then work those statistics. The CDC is not perfect like the WHO. There are some imperfections and there are some mistakes, but basically the people who work at the CDC and at the WHO work for people. They don't work for governments, and that's one of the shining moments of those organizations. And I fear that the United States is trying to strip that away.
Well, yeah, You're right. There are some statistical reasons for wanting improvement to the the way that the CDC has handled the numbers, but inevitably, with this particular administration, you just have to be suspicious about their motives in wanting to kind of swerve around the CDC when gathering information and not have the CDC be the main repository for it anymore. It suggests that, you know, in an Orwellian kind of way, as it was earlier on with the coronavirus task force set up under Vice President Pence, which tried to control all the information about outbreaks and casualty rates and case numbers and death numbers early on. They're now, you know, trying to make sure that the White House is in overall command of all the statistical information, and inevitably that seems like media management more than anything else. And we know, you know, how truthful, is that the right word, the White House is when it comes to their efforts at media management. It's all about trying to make the president look good, or at least less bad and crazy than he now appears to be in the setting of coronavirus. No aspect of presidential responsibilities since he took office has demonstrated so clearly the fact that the president is not in control of what he's meant to be by office in control of. That is, you know, maintaining the safety and security of the country's population.
It's interesting because, of course, there was the big and still continuing the Puerto Rican, horrible handling of the Puerto Rican situation when they were devastated by a hurricane. But now this is one of those segments we can officially say that the coronavirus handling in the United States has been a major cluster. You know what? It's just been horrible. It has been horribly handled. And the proof is in the pudding. I mean, England is getting ready to open up, and they're easing their lockdown. Germany and all these other countries in Europe seem to have kept brought the curve down and kept it down. The United States, no, the curve is not going down. It's going up. 71,000 cases yesterday. And India now, their COVID.
And now the overall total is 3.5 million. Yeah. Do you remember the days when it was argued about whether we could expect to see 100,000 cases? Yes, things are wildly out of control, and of course everybody's, I mean, it's quite clear that everybody knows it now. I don't think, I mean, that's a rhetorical everybody. There are holdouts who still try to deny the truth, of course, and there always will be. We know about the rock-solid Trump base that exists, but it is very, very evident that the United States, the most powerful economy in the world, supposedly the most powerful nation in the world by reputation, cannot handle this problem and is the worst in the world in many ways. It's a highly regrettable and in the end somewhat a powerful indictment about our own leadership system. Something terribly wrong has happened, and it needs to be corrected, and perhaps the democratic process is one way by which it will be protected. It will be altered. But that raises a whole lot of other questions, which we can, if we want, to go into. I don't think it's necessary right now.
You know, it's interesting because the world saw how the United States could be brought to its knees, one of its major cities, one of the top 35 cities, when Katrina hit New Orleans. And New Orleans became basically a dead city for about a month, month and a half, a city of about, I think, 450 or 550,000 people. That was bad enough. But when you look at how the United States has been really incapacitated. I mean, it's amazing how disorganized and how unorganized and how much trouble we're on with this. It just opens up, and I hate to say this, but it does open up, and especially probably to our military leaders, the Joint Chiefs, that the United States is highly, highly vulnerable now to any sort of infection that could be inserted in this country. Never mind dirty bombs and nuclear bombs and supersonic missiles. Wow, look at the United States as it stands today with the coronavirus.
Sure, the emphasis that is needed on biochemical warfare protection is underlined very strongly here. And the most regrettable thing about it all, of course, is and it is a matter of leadership in the end, is how the degree to which this chaos was preventable. I want to use that subject as an occasion for what I've started to call my find the good and praise it moment in our broadcasts. As you know, I've been trying to do that in a habitual way for some time now, and so much so I want to regularize it so much that I have a little sound effect for it. Hold on just one second. That's my fanfare for Find the Good and Praise It. And I want to single out an extraordinary journalistic venture that has come to the fore this week. I don't know if you caught it on the PBS NewsHour on Wednesday night, but the remarkable report coming from, of all places, a journalism school. It's the Graduate School of Journalism at Berkeley, the University of California campus in Northern California. Famous university, famous for many things, but their Graduate School of Journalism, well supported by a MacArthur grant, by the way, a huge $1.5 million grant because of its good reputation for investigative journalism in particular. The MacArthur people single out Lowell Bergman. You remember the CBS 60 Minutes investigative producer and also Frontline on PBS. But here, some graduate students, a large number of graduate students in the school, are in this joint enterprise now, determining joint with other mainstream national media. It's an extraordinary way of bringing good journalists, good journalism students to the fore and give them real life experience, which is valuable to real life. It's a set of partnerships in effect with people like the PBS NewsHour, the Guardian in Britain, but worldwide now, the New York Times and NPR too. They're keeping an eye for us, very close eye on Californian developments with COVID-19. They're operating in every single county of California, and what they came to the fore this week with was a fine piece of reporting that I really want to emphasize its high qualities. It comes from two particular students at the graduate school, Mei Ying Wu and Allison Stamos. And the report, which featured on PBS NewsHour as part of this partnership, is all about how effectively a community can prepare itself for COVID-19, and in this particular case, did very early on. That's the main story. They concentrated on Chinatown in San Francisco, as we know, one of the most famous Chinatowns around the Western world. And as far back as January, they were preparing themselves for COVID-19. One obvious reason to want to prepare themselves, of course, is that as a Chinese community, incredibly dense, tightly populated area of of the city, where many residents, of course, go back to China for the Chinese New Year, the early part of our year, our calendar year. And so, in particular, Chinese Hospital, which is an acute care facility in the heart of Chinatown, run by Zhang Shang, is the name of the man behind this initiative, worked out, you know, a fairly obvious point that if people were going to be going back to China for holidays, they might well be in danger of bringing the virus back into their community. So steps were taken as far back as that, and very thoroughly, making sure that the 15,000 people who are crammed together in just a tight little area of 22 blocks made a really I remember it being called for me, because I was a New Yorker when I was visiting. It was described to me as the densest population west of Manhattan, my own hometown. So they took a lot of very serious measures based on the hospital, but also involving the biggest restaurant in Chinatown, the Far East Cafe. They turned its kitchen into a kitchen for the entire community, closed the restaurant itself, so as to avoid, you know, social transmission, education program for the residents, posters everywhere, word of mouth too, a dedicated education program right from the get-go. This was, then, as I say, this started back in January. So we've now got fewer than 20 cases of COVID-19 in the months since January, right up until this week, amounting to one of the lowest infection rates in the entire nation. And that's a remarkable story brought to us by dedicated young journalism students that I really want to commend. It's online, of course, at the pbs.org/newshour. site, and you'll see the benefit of concentrated work and picking up on a story early, and the content of the story itself. The fact that it was in a very, very clear way a perfectly avoidable catastrophe, and a small community is not, of course, the same as a huge nation like ours, but it shows the virtues of taking early action and taking the problem seriously at an early point.
Well, you know, you point out that, you know, you can take these small examples of success in handling COVID-19, and you can overlay it with the federal government. If the federal government had gotten involved right away with a nationwide mask and social distancing, not necessarily a shutdown as per se in the beginning, but could you just imagine if the nation had gone to a mask and social distancing operation, let's say on February 1st, the results today would be so much different if dictated as a national response.
That is the message of this story, I would claim. And yes, absolutely. We would still have had infections, but of course, all the evidence is pointing clearly to a combination of hand washing, social distancing, and mask wearing does have its very effective results.
It just brings down the curve, and yes, we would have deaths. And would the deaths be like minor? No. When you're looking at a country, no. But you wouldn't be sitting at almost 180,000 deaths 6 months into this, had this been done on a federal effort right at the top, not necessarily having states shut down businesses and everything, but just do smart things. You could have had a shutdown for 1 month and said, everybody, this is what we're doing for 1 month. But the federal government did not get involved. And that is the biggest story and the biggest disappointment, I think, that you'll find in the Trump administration. If you don't like Trump, it's one thing. But if you don't like Trump, just focus in on this as being its biggest failing. And even if you are somebody who's in the middle that doesn't really care about the administration, doesn't like or dislike, it stands out. I think this stands out to everybody except for the hardest 30% of Trump supporters, that this federal response has been horrible. And it opens up our country very poorly how we handle things on a national basis for anybody that now wants to try to disrupt us. Any terrorist sees exactly how poor our federal government is responding to a nationwide disaster.
Yeah, it's a baleful representation of our vulnerability, which nobody wants to know about, but we do need to know about, and it's a very chastening experience for the nation as a whole, and I hope that we learn from it. I really do.
All right. Well, what we're going to do in the future? We're going to get that. That bugle call, for, and we'll have it on hand.
You're going to play it professionally for me. Good.
We'll have it on,
I always knew you were a good bugler.
We'll have it on standby here, and you just tell me when you want to use it, and when we'll use it.
I'm glad I'm in the hands of a really good broadcaster.
Okay. Dave, stay safe and have a good week. We'll speak to you next week.
Certainly look forward to that.
Bye-bye now. David Tarachuk with the Media Beat here on Robinhood Radio. Once again, his website is themediabeat.us. You can also find him at robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand. Click on the Media Beat with David Tarachuk.